If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome back to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. This time I'm talking with machine embroidery artist Rosie James. And if you missed part one, go back one episode and listen about her inspirations and the themes that shape her work. But this is the second part of our Needle Exchange, and we dive into the technical side of things. How Rosie engineers large-scale stitched pieces, the magic of loose threads, something that is a bit of a Rosie James classic, and her experiments with reflective textiles. Hi, visibility. She also reflects on the evolution of her work. We touch on her cultural influences, and she shares a very musical fact that not a lot of people know about her. I've known Rosie for over a decade. She was in my Push Stitchery book. I've exhibited her work, and it was a complete thrill to dive into it and talk around the houses, bus stations, airports with her. So I'm sure you'll enjoy this show. If you fancy some more machine embroidery, then dial all the way back to episode 2, where I talk with Jack Roberts, aka JPR Stitch, an abstract machine embroidery artist and a good all-round guy. I'll be back next week with another conversation with somebody else from the world of stitch. But until then, enjoy the show.
And of course, I didn't. I just used the same thread, which was great because the other thing I liked about it was I liked the idea of it looking like a drawing hanging in space. So the lines would be just, it would be like a drawing with no surface, you know, no paper or not. You're like, you've taken the pencil lines off the paper and you're just hanging them in the air. I wanted to find the most see-through fabric I could find so that you wouldn't be able to see it. And so I went around looking for all these see-through fabrics. And the best one I found was in my workshop, just like, but I only had like a 1 meter of it. I didn't have enough, and I don't know where I'd got it from or what it was or anything. So I ended up using just silk organza, which is nice, actually, because it does have a little bit of a white tone to it. So it did give it a cloudy kind of a feel to it, which was quite nice, actually. But, yeah, it was quite nice doing something that big.
How do you do the engineering on that? Because obviously machine embroidery, a piece like that has to be somewhat structural, right? So that you can, you don't want it to be all puckered. You don't want it to seem pointless. I just wonder what the trade-offs are as you start to scale things out.
Yeah, I just thought, the bigger you go, the easier it gets, I think, because I still use a hoop. So I do each section is hooped up, so it's not puckering up, so it's all pulled in the hoop nice and tight. So it's easy to sew. And then I just take the hoop out and move to the next bit. And because it's so big, the lines are kind of spread out. So you haven't got so much complicated tiny details. You've just got these lines. It just has slightly different problems than when they're small. But I actually prefer it. The bigger it gets, I find it easier. Yeah, the smaller it gets too fiddly for me. I can't do anything small. Well, I can, but not too small.
Dumb question. Do you stitch quite slowly? Does the machine, are you quite fast when you're producing them? Like, I've seen Harriet in action. She's like foot down, like she was putting on a zip or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, that kind of speed or something is bonkers. I wonder whether with yours there's a slowness to it to make sure that the tension of the thread is right or anything.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, isn't it, how what people do? No, I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I would say I was definitely not slow, but not hugely fast either. But I am fast-ish. Because I know when I do workshops, I always tell people to try and go as slowly as they can, really, to try and get and then get used to it and then kind of warm up, you know, get a bit faster. But then you don't want to go so fast that you can't control it. And also I found that basically you want to be relaxed. So if you're very tense and you're not done it before and you're a bit like holding onto the edge of the hoop like a, and then sometimes when you're very tense, you can put your foot down on the foot pedal too fast. And then you go and you get this tiny, tight little stitches, which are quite nice, actually. But, yeah, you can. And then it's so you have to kind of relax into it a bit, which you do eventually. And then you're not going too fast or too slow, really, somewhere in between. And that depends. Everybody's different as to their point where they feel relaxed enough to just do it without thinking about it.
You've made the same statement, I think. It was akin to just using a pencil, but maybe sometimes you're pressing a lot harder on the pencil and softer on the pencil, and that kind of analogy.
Yeah, because it's like with a pencil. When you press harder, you get a different kind of mark to when you're doing it quite lightly. The same with the sewing machine. If you put your foot down, you'll get tiny little stitches if you just move the hoop slowly and put your foot down. So you get this different stitched line. It's thicker, and it's quite nice. When you feel it, it feels more raised on the surface of the fabric. And then if you go quite, if you move the hoop quite quickly and push it, you know, back and forth really quickly, you get these great big stitches, you know, you sort of, so you get this very thin line because the stitches are literally like that. So you get, yeah, you can play around with it and get different kinds of mark.
And then those in turn will have different effects on the fabric. I know yours is hooped, isn't it? But they will still be the push and pull of the fabric and the thread playing off against each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I always use the hoop because I found it easier to control. You know, when I'm doing those kind of drawings of figures or whatever, if I want to get a really kind of detailed drawing of it, then I like to have control of the hoop because then I can really get in there and do it. But of course, sometimes you can do it without the hoop and just hold onto the fabric. And then I think you have to be a little bit more freer in the way that you draw then, because you can sort of get looser.
Yeah. Shout out to Kaz Holmes probably at this point, isn't it? Yeah. when you take a photograph of a situation and then you transpose that, do you do line drawings based on that? And do you draw knowing that you're really hoping to do this all as a continuous line? Have you developed that? Because at no point, and I might be wrong here, but at no point have you said, I studied illustration. So I'm guessing you've found this out all for yourself.
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I mean, I like drawing because when I did my textile degree, we did a lot of drawing, but it was always flowers, lots of flowers and patterns because it was all about pattern and, you know, so we did a lot of making and a lot of drawing of flowers and nature and all that stuff. We very rarely drew people and we would draw. We didn't even do that much life drawing, really. We did a bit, but really not much, I suppose, because it was focused on textile design, and most textiles, particularly for fashion, involve flowers and if they've got drawn elements in them. And so, but so I did do a lot of drawing. So, but when it came to drawing people, I know, like with life drawing, I never really liked life drawing because they didn't have any clothes. Not that I'm squeamish, but you know what I mean? I wanted to draw the clothes. I found it a bit boring drawing this, you know, the naked body. I'd be like, yeah. And then when I was teaching fashion and textiles, I used to love teaching the figure drawing with the fashion students because then we could pile on a load of clothes and they would have to draw them And what we used to do was we would start the model off with loads of clothes on and then draw them. And then she'd take something off and then we'd draw that. And so we'd keep going until they'd eventually be doing life drawing, you know, a mixture of both. And that kind of thing I used to like doing myself. And then I like drawing from fashion magazines. I love fashion magazines because the people in it are not, they're very different from people walking down the street. They are people posing in a very, all sorts of weird ways, in a very, to basically show off whatever the clothes are. And the clothes are always fabulous. So fashion magazines, those figures are such a contrast to your average person walking down the street. They're really great fun to stitch. And I usually, when I do workshops, I get people to draw from photographs in fashion magazines. Because it's a good place to practice. So you can start with that. And then if you want to go on then and take your own photographs and work from your own photographs. Oh, yeah, so drawing figures. So then basically, so I am used to drawing figures in that sense. But then what I do is, so I take the photographs and then I print out an image, the exact size that I want it. So if I've done a figure and I want it to be, you know, life size or A4, whatever, I print it out that size. Oh, yeah, then I trace it. So I'm basically tracing that figure. But like you were saying, I am bearing in mind the fact that I am going to have to, this is going to be a contour drawing. So I draw it knowing that that's what I'm going to do. So where all the sort of shadows are and folds and pleats and things, the line carries on around the pleats and keeps going to the side. And like when I'm drawing a face, when I'm doing courses, I have a separate bit where we go through the face, because what I do is I trace the face and I'm drawing around the edge of the face, say, but then if I can, I will draw the line where the eye is so that you're coming in one line and then going back to the side of the face and then coming in and then so that everything is, if I can, I'm joining everything up almost.
Mm.
Unless it looks weird, in which case, you know, you'll have to stop and start, but...
Mm.
So, yeah, so that, and then there's no single lines. So there's no bits where it's just kind of shading. It's all kind of keeps going. Yeah, so I'm doing that deliberately when I'm tracing.
I bet you love a pair of glasses. That's probably a good one for joining the sides of things, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you've got it.
Definitely makes life easier. And then, so then you've also got the textile design skill set. If you're doing applique, are you using fabrics you've already found, or have you ever gone to the point of deliberately producing textiles?
Oh, I have actually. Yeah, no, I have. Sometimes I've got a screen that has stripes on it, so sometimes I'll screen print a little bit of stripey something if I want it a particular colour, because I've got the screen there, I can just do that. But and then sometimes I did a piece where I digitally printed, it was a piece based on a building in Salford. So I took a load of patterns. There were lots of, it was a Tudor building. So there was all these Tudorish sort of patterns and tiles on the floor. So all those kind of patterns, photographed them and then just digitally printed them onto some fabric and then cut that up to use in that piece. But yeah, so sometimes it's interesting to have something, use fabric that's relevant to the whatever it is you're doing.
Mm.
Mostly I just use whatever I've got.
Yeah, and is there do you have any rules in your head about the use of applique? Because you don't use it wholesale. I don't think I've ever seen you really do all of the pieces of a person in lots of different pieces of material or anything.
No, I like to only have a few pieces, because sometimes if you put too much in, then it's, you can't see so much of the line drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that to be mostly it, with a few bits of colour in it. Although sometimes I've done a piece where I thought, if you were to just put no line drawing in and just have lots of bits of fabric, you know, which is quite effective.
Mm.
I liked it, actually. But then I thought, yeah, I kind of like wanted there to be the actual line drawing on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of disappears, you know what I mean? There was too much. There was either one or the other. So, yeah, so I tend to just put a few bits of colour in there.
Sometimes they come across a bit like, almost like sound effects, but they're not sound effects, they're colour effects or something.
Yeah.
You know, but just little extra notes that you add into the story.
Yeah, just something to, like you say, like a little extra. It's like an accent of colour, or it might be sometimes there's some fabrics I want to use. Like I've had all those stripy shirts that I wanted to do something with, so I did some. That was when I was doing the figures and then the shadowy figure next to it. So you'd have the drawn figure and then the appliqued figure made out of the stripy fabric. So then, so it wasn't within the actual appliqued bit, wasn't within the actual figure itself. And then I just started adding little bits here and there within the figure itself. And I kind of stopped doing the little ghostly silhouettes.
Mm.
Sort of stopped doing that, really. So it's like I've just been putting the colour into the garments.
Right.
Also, you can have fun with that then, because you can make people wear all sorts of mad things. So they might have been wearing a very boring suit, but you can give them something made out of some fabric where even though the pattern on it is tiny, when you put it on a tiny figure, it looks like he's wearing a suit made out of some, you know, mad IKEA fabric or something. Or just something, you know, you can really make it. You can bring something, you can make people do something that they weren't doing. Yes. It's like putting, sometimes I like to stitch the figure, say that somebody's sitting on a beach, but then put them somewhere else, put them in the middle of the street in front of an electricity substation or something. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. Do you think there's a sort of a path that your work is following? Like, you know, you've explored different layers and kind of dialed that back. Do you get a sense of a path, or are you just taking the ideas as they come and kind of just rolling with it?
What, you mean a path, a sort of...
Are you heading towards a magnum opus? Do you feel like there's a...
Definitely. You know? Ooh, no, I know, definitely not. What happens is you're doing something because you think, oh, that's a good... Like, even just talking to you now, I'm thinking, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I wish I was taking notes, because anyway... So you're doing something, and then you think, oh, yeah, I must do that. And then, so then you move on, then you do that. Or then, so it's all, you don't even plan it. Somebody might ask you to do some exhibition, you think, what am I going to do for that? And then something occurs to you, so you do that. So it's all completely random. You just sort of go with the flow, which is what's quite interesting, is to look back. Because every now and again you have to stop, and because at the moment I'm trying to have a bloody big clear out.
Mm-hmm.
Over 24 years I've had my big shed thing, and over the years I've not really done that. So there's more and more stuff has been gathering in there. People give me machines and fabric, and you know, I use it or I don't. But now there's so much I can barely move in there. And I thought, also, it kind of, you need to clear your head. You know, my head is like. And so I've been in there sorting stuff out and just pulled out the work I did for my MA, which is in a suitcase under something, you know, and you think, oh, right. And then so I can clearly see what I've been doing over all those years and how it's kind of moved on a little bit each time, you know, like the threads have got longer or the coloured fabrics have shifted or the focus has shifted a bit from people there, but they're still basically... Still, the basic thing of looking at people doing stuff, but my MA work was very different. But I have been starting to bring those elements of that into what I'm doing, because I'm in this group called Filaments,
mm-hmm.
and they're just five of us, and we all kind of live near each other, but we're not necessarily textile artists. We're all just artists. We all do different things, really, but we do stuff. There's an old church near me, which is run by the Church's Conservation Trust. And it's just empty, you know. They don't have any services or anything. So a group of us in the village where I live got together. So we're the Friends of St. Mary's. And we've been doing this for about 10 years now. So we put events on in the church. And because I'm an artist, I want to put art exhibitions on in there. So that's how I got together with these five of us. We were in there and we just thought... We could do some mad things in here. So we use that church as a sort of playground, you know. It allows us to do stuff that perhaps we wouldn't normally do. This is where the reflective stuff worked really well in there for me, because I made a massive panel, like 8 metres long, which hung from the beam in the church, and it had a reflectively stitched drawing of two workmen, rappellers or whatever they call, rappelling, coming down this rope. So they look like they're coming out down from the roof on this big piece of silk. But it was made with this reflective thread. So you could see it, but you had to take a photograph of it in order for it to light up. So that church enabled me to just really do a massive thing, you know. And then working with them, because they're all doing different things, I've started to think more about doing much more three-dimensional big stuff that could work in that space. And going back to my MA work and looking at that and thinking, you know, that didn't have any stitched drawing elements in it at all. So then you think to yourself, do you carry on, or do you sort of abandon the stitch drawing, the figures, and go back to doing something else? But then I think, well, you don't really, because it's all sort of just, it all feeds in together. Everything's like, it's like you're going down a river and there's all these tributaries coming in, sort of pushing you off a bit more, you know. Mm. That's what it feels like.
Yeah. It's nice when you're able to reflect back and make sense of it all, because you can only do that upon reflection, can't you? You can't really necessarily make sense of it. I'm in a similar boat with everything that's going on with this art gallery. You know, I look back and I think, even the fact that, like, I used to work in a pub, and so when it's time to politely tell people to go,
yeah,
like, I've got used to that, only these guys aren't drunk on Stella Artois. It's much easier than it used to be.
Where's the art gallery then?
Yeah, it's in Crewe, so that's where I live now. Yeah. So I've got a community interest company. We've started an art gallery. We have regular workshops. We're doing a series of events. And Crewe's never had an art gallery.
No, wow.
So this is like version one of it, but I'm hoping that we can get to a point of having something, you know. I went to London a little while ago and I went to the Whitechapel Art Gallery, and I was struck by that because that feels like the right scale of place. But if I am able to realise that dream, then I will be having a dedicated embroidery and textile art gallery in there. So watch out is all I'm saying.
Wow, that's amazing. Fantastic.
But it's one of those things, like I say, where me doing this now is a very much a reflection of the experiences that I've had and the things that I've done, because I've never really been an artist. Mm. I've always ended up being this kind of curator, ambassador. You know, I've exhibited your work, you know, I've done all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
This is now, looking back, the tributaries are all coming together in that
respect.
Yes,
exactly.
It's quite similar.
Yeah.
It's nice when that happens. You can sort of realise that you're in the right place for you, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. You realise that what you're doing is building on all that stuff that you've learned and done over the years. You've built on it, haven't you? You haven't just plucked it out of thin air. This is something that's you've been leading up to, in a way.
It's quite nice, in a way, because you can go, oh, right, that's why I was doing that thing that made no sense whatsoever at the time. And everyone was like, what are you doing that for? I'm like,
well, exactly. I mean, I remember that book when you first... Yes, exactly. I think that was the first time I'd ever, you know, had my work featured in a book. And that was I was just looking at it now and I was thinking, you picked some really good artists in there who are still, you know, still going, still doing it and still, yeah, really interesting.
And that was like 2010 as well. That was quite a long time ago, you know. And then we did then I took some of those people on and we did the knitting and stitching shows. We did London and Dublin and Harrogate and Milton Keynes and stuff. Yeah. No, I'm like, that book's out of print now, but I'm so proud of that book.
Yeah.
The whole series, because there were four of them, so there was a jewellery one, a print one, and a paper one as well.
Yeah.
And they're a fantastic little collection of books.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, very satisfied with that. Let's move on to the tough topics now. I feel like we've had a good run there. Do you have a favourite band or a favourite album?
Oh, yeah. I like these topics.
Let's have a go.
it's nice that you... what's the word? Warned me that you were going to. I spent the whole week thinking, maybe it's them. Oh, maybe it's them. Maybe it's that. You know what I mean? It's just, you just think, oh, I don't know. Because there's just so many, and then so many eras of your life, isn't there, where you like this and then you like that and then you think, oh, I like that. But anyway, at the moment, I'll tell you what I'm into at the moment. I like folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm into a band called Lancome, who are from Dublin, and they play really gothic kind of folk music. And I'm playing their LP at the moment, which is called False Lancome. Have you heard of them?
No, I haven't. I mean, I have moments of folk. I think I'm a bit more mellow folk.
Yeah.
Is gothic folk, do you mean like quite dramatic folk?
Well, it's sort of, they describe it as gothic, because it is a bit, like the first song on this LP is called Go Dig My Grave.
Okay.
So it's all those kind of, you know.
Romance.
Proper folk miserableness.
Right, yeah. But I mean, that, I guess that's it, isn't it? There was a lot of those kind of darkness in those songs back in the day. We kind of forget, don't we? Because it seems like an old mode of music or whatever, but it's like...
Yeah, well, these people, Lancome, they dig up these old folk songs and they play them in this quite... So it's the subject matter's quite gothic, but they play it in a very droney sort of way. So it is quite a gothic-y sound, I think. But they're very good at their instruments, but and the singing as well, you know. But they do it in a way that isn't traditional folky. It's very... It's quite contemporary almost, because they've dirtied it up a bit, you know what I mean? There's some another folky group, they used to live in Margate, not far from where I live, but they've moved to Ireland now, but they were called the Lunar Tractors, and they were doing some amazing things. They would take these folk songs, but then they just messed with them, you know, and then they wrote their own folk songs, which were about contemporary issues, stuff going on in Kent, you know, or whatever. So, and yet they, again, their voices and their musicians, it was so good, but they did something else with it. They took it somewhere else. So, yeah, I'm kind of like that at the moment, I suppose.
I was going to say, there's a project that I liked a while ago called The Imagined Village, which had
I've heard of that.
Yeah, so they had like John and Eliza Carthy, but they also had like Benjamin Zephaniah was part of it, and then the Asian Dub Foundation, and it was kind of that electrifying or like modern remixing of folk music.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly, that whole concept is akin to what we were saying ages ago about traffic jams in machine embroidery or whatever.
Yes.
It's that same turnabout, isn't it?
Yeah, it's that bringing two things together that should be opposite. Yeah, and then it becomes something exciting. But one of my favourite singers at the moment is this woman called C-Matt, and she's Irish, and she wants to be a country singer, I think. I think she describes herself as a country singer. But what I like about her is she's just completely, she's got a great voice, but she's her own person, you know. She doesn't give a shit about, you know, looking a certain way or behaving a certain way. She just kind of like... doesn't care, you know, but she belts it out, and she's just, all her songs are written, she's written them herself, and she does one with John Grant, and he sings with her, and the two of them together, it's really good. I think she's really interesting. Well, that kind of young person who's just appearing to just go for it without, you know, trying to pander to any sort of music standards or whatever it is.
You know them when they come along. Funnily enough, the singer Sia, who became quite a well-known global musician, I had one of her albums called, what is it? Oh, no, I knew I'd forget the name of it now.
What was her name again?
Sia, S-I-A. So she did a lot of...
Sia, yeah.
So, but some of her early stuff, you know, she did songs about, like, one was called Drink to Get Drunk, and another one was like, I'm Not Important to You. Like, she was singer-songwriting her stuff in her own voice, long before she kind of blew up or whatever. Yeah, I appreciate that.
No, I love that one, yeah.
Do you listen to music while you're working?
Well, it depends what I'm doing, I suppose. If I'm just doing something where I'm not having to think about anything, then, yeah, I put CDs on. I've got no internet in my shed, so I've just got a load of CDs. And, so I play them. I like the Arctic Monkeys as well. I was having an Arctic Monkeys phase last week and playing all their stuff.
How do you feel about the newer stuff? This is my wife. My wife's well into the Arctic Monkeys, and obviously the transition between AM and Tranquility Base was quite a big one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love the new stuff. I love that Tranquility Base Hotel, because I sort of, I came into them a bit late, really. I had that very first LP and then I didn't get into them much. And then I got that Tranquility Base Hotel and I really liked it. And then I think, I don't know why, I suddenly realised they had all these other stuff I'd missed out on. So then I was like, oh! So, yeah, so I really like it. But the new on the car, don't like that so much as that Tranquility Base Hotel, but I still like it.
What I found, actually, is the car's quite good to listen to in the car, whether that's deliberate or not, but it works out quite well as a travel album.
Yeah.
Films or TV, what are your favourites?
Films, yeah, I love films. We have a film society in Maidstone, not far again from where I live, so I go to that. And because most of the films on the cinema are a bit too shit. Some of them are okay. But so I watched, so my favourite film, though, I was thinking about that, and I've decided that my favourite film is The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
Because, well, it was between that and Tarkovsky film called Stalker. I mean, they're both, you know, quite different, but there's lots of similarities, really. But The Wizard of Oz, when I was doing my MA, and one of the essays I wrote was about colour in film. So, of course, I started looking at The Wizard of Oz because I like that moment where it goes from black and white to colour. And when I started looking at The Wizard of Oz and watching it, I was thinking, oh, there's actually way more to this film than I'd really, if you just watch it, but it's, there's so much going on in that. And that thing about where it goes from black and white to colour, when she sort of says, gee, Toto, I guess we're not in Kansas anymore, you know, and that everything, she opens the door and it goes into this mad world and they change into colour. You know, that kind, I love that sort of moment. And then, but then she spends the whole of that film trying to get back to her home, doesn't she? So she doesn't want, she wants to get back to that grey, black and white world. And then just the whole notion of the Wizard of Oz being a man behind a curtain, and it's just, it's bonkers, but brilliant. And the songs are brilliant. And Judy, everything, it's just, I love that film.
I was going to say, it's quite the nerve that they had to do that. Do you know what I mean? To not make a completely Technicolor film, but to transition between it. Like,
yeah.
That must have blown people's minds at the time.
I know. Yeah, because it was 1939, I think, wasn't it? But then, in 1939, I think the whole Technicolor was a huge thing. And the Technicolor then was, I think the colours were stunning. I think the colours were stronger and richer than anything you get on digital.
Right.
You know, that proper film. I mean, some of those films from the 50s, you know, a lot of those colour films then that use Technicolor, the colours are fantastic. Sort of really saturated.
Like when your nana's got the colour up on the telly. I don't think they can even do that now, can they? But I always used to go around my gran's house and be like, who are all these really suntan people? Why are they so bright?
Yeah, you used to be able to turn it up, didn't you? I forgot.
Yeah, you really did, yeah.
Yeah, you can't do that now, can you?
I don't think so. I don't know. Seems like we've missed out on that, isn't it? It being too loud and it being too bright, which is like, that's funny. You go into
the Stalker, the other film. Have you seen that one?
I have not, no.
That's a very arty, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky Russian film. And it's very, I like the kind of film like this, where it's quite strange and slow and, you know, but in that film, it goes from black and white to colour as well. And there's only really three main characters. They're going into this area called the Zone, and they go, so they're in this very black and white world, and they, the Stalker is one of these men, and he's taking the other two into this zone. On to get to the zone, they have to sort of go through this bleak industrial-looking landscape, and then they get on a sort of little truck thing that goes along a railway line, and they're sitting on this truck, and there's this very long, slow shot of them just sitting there, their faces, you know, looking around, and it seems to go on and on. And then eventually it just turns colour, and you sort of almost don't notice. Not like Dorothy opening the door, and it's, you know, it's sort of, and then they're in this zone then, and then all these weird things happen, and, you know, but it's one of those films again that you can watch again and again. You just think, oh, I didn't, what's that? You know, it's all these, yeah, it's brilliant.
I like it. I like a film where you get a bit uncomfortable with the length of time something happens. I think it's called The Lobster. There was a film a while ago that had Olivia Colman in it, and that, like, the end doesn't end when you think it's going to end. It's almost like the scene should end, but then I might be wrong about the specifics, but it's almost like the people are just there.
Yeah.
Just waiting.
Yeah.
And waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and then the film ends or something, you know, like they just string it out. You're like,
yeah,
whoa.
Yeah.
Getting uncomfortable. I like that. Good books.
Oh, books. Oh, yeah. My favourite book is a book called The House for Mr. Biswas by V.S. Naipaul. That's my favourite book. But again, it changes, doesn't it? So I decided to pick that one just because it's one of those books. I read it and I was so pulled into it. I was in that book. And then when it finishes, you're like, yeah. Where am I? What am I doing? You know. And then, so I haven't read it now. It must be about 10 years since I read it. And I thought, I must read that again. Because I thought, why would I pick that as my favourite book when I haven't read it for so long? But it was just the last time I read a book that really pulled me into it. It was just about a guy in Trinidad, and he works as a journalist at a local paper, and his wife's family are wealthy. I'm not sure when it's set, probably 50s maybe. But his wife's family are very wealthy. So he kind of lives with them, but there's so many of them. He just wants a house of his own. So the book is about him trying to get his own house and all the things. Every time he tries, something goes wrong. What's interesting about it is all the people. You know, it's a whole world that I don't know anything about, Trinidad, and, you know, the history of it and the life there and the different, you know. So that's the kind of book I like, I think. Somewhere that's not anything like my own life. It's totally different. Yeah, it's my favourite book.
It's only when you finish a book and you're like, I read 100 Years of Solitude, which took a long time.
That used to be my favourite book, actually.
Yeah. But as I was getting to, like, let's say 97 years, when I knew that I wasn't far from the end, I started to be like, oh, I'm going to miss this place.
Yeah.
Funny little world and all that. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. That's a lovely book like that.
I was saying that to someone the other day, like, one of the things I loved about that book, there's a particular point where a man's wife's having a rant about something, and he writes one sentence, but it goes on for a page and a half. And I was like, come on, well done. Like, that sort of stuff. I love that. Very happy.
Yeah, I used to love that book.
Is there a fact that not a lot of people know about Rosie Jane?
Yeah, a fact. Not really. Oh, I know.
Go on.
I play the accordion.
There you go. That's a good one.
I don't play it very well.
Right. When did you start doing that?
I started doing that about 10 years ago. My friend and I became obsessed with accordions. You know, we'd go and see bands with accordions in and admiring the accordions. And then we thought, why don't we, you know, can't be that hard, can it? Oh, that's what we spoke to somebody and said, oh, it's dead easy.
Right.
What? So anyway, we went to this shop in London called Allodi, Mr. Allodi. Well, right. It's owned by Emilio Allodi, who's a proper Italian maker of accordions, and his shop in Lewisham, in Lee actually, is just full of accordions, old ones, half knackered ones, new ones. It was like a paradise of accordions. And they've got these Italian ones there covered in sparkly bits and, you know, mother of pearl keys. We were like amazed. Anyway, we both came out of there with an accordion, the cheapest one he had, these Chinese ones, and they were like 200 quid. And so we came out of there, and then we had to go and find a teacher. So we found a teacher near us, a lovely guy who taught us both together at the same time, you know, so we'd go to these classes and started from scratch. And then we realised it's not easy to do because you've got to play the keys and the bass notes and move it in and out all whilst not looking at it, you know, you're just facing, so you can't even look at it. It took us ages to get the hang of it. So eventually, the poor teacher, we would come back every other week or something and we'd be no better than we'd been the last week. But he was great. He let, you know, he gave us all these books to work through and stuff. And so now, this is like 10 years later, I can play, my partner plays guitar and stuff. So what we do is we, any song that we like, we work out a little tune. So I can play the keyboard and I can play it. I can do it now. I can actually play them together and I can read the music. So I can figure things out. And so we just play little tunes and I play the tune and the bass notes and everything. And he plays the guitar. And so it's quite good fun. But I don't really, you know, I don't know anything complicated.
Is it good for your forearms? I feel like there's a lot of effort going through your forearms and your wrists.
Yeah, it's very good for your forearms. Well, it would be if you were going like this all the time.
I was going to say, get rid of your bingo wings as well.
Exactly.
But I mean, That's a great one. Yeah, I'd never thought. It is one of those instruments that you just think, actually, there's a lot more going on there than you would first
think. I know, exactly. Huh. Don't believe anybody who tells you it's easy.
No, tough, and you heard it here first. Rosie, thank you for having a needle exchange with me.
Yeah, thank you for asking me. It was fun.
Been good, that. Right. Ooh. Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.